I'm going to call the House Interim Committee on Rural Communities Land Use and Water to order. Today is December the 12th. Welcome, everybody. Happy holidays. We are going to be going through 1, 2, 3, 4 items and then introduction of some LC concepts after that. But why don't we get started? Is Representative... No. That got moved down to the bottom.
Yes.
Sorry. Let's get started. We've got our Metro Council President, Tom Hughes, and Andy, his regional affairs guy. Randy is off on personal leave for a while, and I talked with him a little bit yesterday. Wishes he could be here, I'm sure, but otherwise we get to hear from these two fine gentlemen instead of Mr. Tucker. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It takes two of us to replace
That's
Randy
right.
At least. I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before the committee today. My name is Tom Hughes, and I'm the president of the Metro Council from Portland area's regional government. First of all, as a bit of context, as you know, Metro is charged with maintaining the urban growth boundary around the Metro area to make sure that we have at least a 20-year land supply to accommodate growth over that period of time. And over the years, we have evolved the way we make urban growth decisions, and that has had a number of steps to it. First, back in 2007, you will recall that the legislature authorized the metro region to create urban and rural reserves to accommodate the next 50 years of growth. And then in 2010, Metro and the three counties, Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah County, came to an agreement on the 50-year urban reserves map. Despite some legal setbacks and a trip through the legislature in 2015, I'm now convinced that our region will soon complete our work on urban and rural reserves and send a final proposal to DLCD. So while adopting the urban reserves map in 2010, Metro also changed how we plan for growth, and essentially we flipped the process around. So as we used to do it, we would do the study of projected growth. We would assess the available capacity of land that was within the urban growth boundary, and then we would determine whether or not we were going to expand the urban growth boundary. What we're now doing is we're saying, look, let's ask the cities that are going to be asked to govern this property to do the planning in advance so that we know that we have planned before we make the expansions. We've also provided funds. We now collect a fund, a part of the construction excise tax goes to funding concept planning for new expansions. And so for the 2017 session, we've sort of assessed where we are going with this progression of changes in the way we do business. And in order to set up for the 2017 session, we convened a task force composed of several of the region's mayors. Two of the three county chairs, Multnomah County, actually chose not to participate directly, but so we added an additional mayor from Multnomah County to fill that. And then also representatives from the Home Builders Association and the environmental community and a staff member from DLCD. And we met five times over a period of about 9 months. The argument or the level that or the bar that I set for the committee was that we would arrive at whatever we arrived at would have a sufficient enough consensus that everyone felt comfortable having that come to you as a proposed legislation, and that if everybody isn't lined up at the witness table when we mm-hmm. testify for it, at least there won't be anybody back in the audience saying no, we don't want this to pass. And so we did arrive at that level of consensus by the last meeting, at least to accommodate concept, and we were well served during that whole period by the staff that Metro convenes for MPAC, which is called MTAC, which is the technical staff for most of the region's jurisdictions, plus representatives from the Home Builders and Thousand Friends and some other special interest groups. So we are proposing to you then a slight change in the way we do business, and what we are going to do is we hope to respond in a way that allows us to answer the three really most vexing problems that we face when we expand the urban growth boundary. How do we plan these areas? Who's going to govern them once they're established, and who, as a side issue to that, who is going to finance the infrastructure that needs to take place? We used as sort of a poster child for what we were trying to accomplish the story of Wilsonville. Most of you are familiar with Wilsonville. Wilsonville has experienced a substantial amount of growth over the last few decades. They are one of the few communities in the region that has a slight tip towards jobs in the jobs housing imbalance. They have slightly more jobs. They have more people coming into Wilsonville each day to work than they have housing for them, and they would like to establish more housing. They received there was an urban growth boundary expansion not too long in the last effort in their area, in an area called Frog Pond, and the Frog Pond expansion has not yet been developed, in part because extending infrastructure, sewer and water in particular, to that site has been challenging in terms of its expense. The addition of their proposed 300-acre expansion would offer a more efficient way to extend services into Frog Pond. So for a bunch of reasons, Wilsonville had done the advanced planning. They received a grant from us to do the concept planning. They had a plan in place for how they would finance the infrastructure. They had several arguments in favor of how it addressed their own community's imbalance between jobs and housing. It met several of the 2040 planning criteria that we use in the region, but we couldn't do it. And we couldn't do it for a couple of reasons. The first reason, the first stumbling block, which meant we didn't even get to the second stumbling block, was that we could not demonstrate a regional capacity need for additional land. So if you looked at the entire Portland metropolitan area, there was sufficient land in the region to accommodate the housing needs of the region. There was simply not enough in Wilsonville to accomplish what Wilsonville as a community wanted to accomplish. Most of us understand why that is. Most of us don't have a big problem with it. But on the other hand, many of us who have been in the business for a long time looked at that and said, you know, expanding by 300 acres wouldn't actually break the system. And if there were a good reason to do it, and if we had good criteria to apply, that size of an expansion, which is relatively modest, we could do that without interfering with the overall land use planning system. And so, we met for several months, and we established some criteria, create more local certainty about growth decisions, require strong proposals from cities for urban growth boundary expansions, advance the region's climate smart goals, which the legislature gave us the authority to put together a number of sessions ago, and to provide for greater choice and mix of housing in communities. So Annie's going to describe a little bit more for you what that looks like in some detail. I wanted to basically just to set the context as to what we were doing. At the end of the day, everybody agreed to the criteria that they either liked it or would not oppose it. And so we think we come to you with a fairly strong consensus of the people who have been involved in this process for a long time. So, Annie?
So, thank you, Andy Shaw, Regional Affairs Manager with Metro, Vice Chair Clem, and committee members. As Tom mentioned, we're looking for ways to evolve the UGB decision-making process to really focus more on city readiness so that when we do expand, we've got a partner locally that can actually put the roads and the pipes and the parks on the ground to support development. This describes what Tom mentioned briefly, the old way that we did UGB, our UGB decision-making prior to 2010, which is we would do our every 5 and now every 6 year look at the 20 years of growth going forward, both population and employment growth, and determine if we, from a mathematical basis, needed more land or didn't need more land. Then we would expand somewhere, and lastly, we would plan it. That's how we added Damascus to the urban growth boundary, and many complications followed that that have not led to development in that area. So we've evolved the land use system. And after in 2010, we used this newer approach where we worked with the city of Hillsborough and a number of other cities, helping to fund the planning work ahead of time so they could propose to Metro and to the region what they were trying to accomplish in making an urban growth boundary expansion. And then when we found that we had a need for additional land, we were able to add South Hillsborough to the boundary, and we were able to pick that location based on a variety of factors. But one of the key factors was the existence of urban reserves at the time in Washington County. What the task force, didn't realize they did this, there we go. What the task force is proposing is adding elements to each of those steps along the way. So the first step is to really hone in and clarify what is it we expect from a city in making a proposal for a UGB expansion. Our mayors and Thousand Friends and home builders talked a lot about what are the kinds of reductions in traffic that we could hope to get by bringing housing closer in to where jobs are. What is the overall balance of housing in a community? How is that community helping the region achieve a mix of housing choices for our residents, both single family and multifamily, and helping us address affordability? That's actually Metro's job, this first step. Metro will be working with our local partners, with MPAC and MTAC, our advisory committees, as Tom mentioned, over the next 6 to 8 months to really hone in on that, and Metro can adopt that set of expectations for cities as a code changed locally. But we want to do that in conjunction with this next piece, which is asking the legislature to give Metro and our region the authority to make expansions to the urban growth boundary in the middle of our urban growth forecasting cycle. So every 6 years, we do the big forecast looking out 20 years and determine if we have enough land for population and employment growth over that period of time. What we'd like to do is, in the middle of that cycle, to the extent that cities come forth with modest requests for expansions for housing, to have the authority to add those lands in if the city can show that they can bring the kind of housing that our region needs, that housing would have gone further out. Right now, part of our forecasting process estimates how much of the 7-county region growth occurs within our UGB and how much will go outside to other areas in Camas, Washington, in Canby, and other areas outside the metro region. As a part of our climate strategy, we would like to enable folks to be closer to where they work, their home to be closer to where they work, so we can reduce the amount of time spent on the road and reduce congestion and reduce car trips from outside the region into employment. So a place like Wilsonville, having some additional housing would help to accomplish that goal. So we'd roll all those up into a set of factors that Metro could consider in looking at an expansion at this mid-cycle point. The task force recommended that authority be capped at 1,000 acres. So during that midpoint, the Metro Council would have limited authority to add some acres. And then 3 years later, at the normal forecasting point, we'd look again at where we are and if we, at that point, need additional land or have enough to accommodate growth going forward. The last piece here is just getting clear authority to go ahead and pick that place. If we've got a Wilsonville who's done the planning, who's coming forth with a proposal for 300 acres or so, that Metro would be authorized to actually pick that place. Right now, we have some requirements that say look around the region to make sure you're picking the best place to add based on a series of factors. In this mid-cycle authority, we'd like to be able to simply respond to the city request or city's requests and make an UGB adjustment in that area. I would note that we did a quick calculation, and assuming the urban reserves map that we have, that we agreed to in 2010, if we use this full authority of 1,000 acres every mid-cycle for the duration of the life of reserves, we would use less than 30% of the urban reserves in that period of time. So we're talking about a small portion of the land that our region has identified for future urban growth would be eligible during this this flexible moment in our cycle. And we would, of course, continue to do the full six-year review and see if we need land, which most forecasting cycles we have found a need for some additional land. This last cycle was the first time we did not find a need because of the market response around multifamily and growth that was occurring within existing cities. And the recession that we just encountered meant there wasn't a lot of construction that had gone on in the 26,000 acres that we'd added in the previous 15 years. So we're now playing a bit of catch-up, but this proposal, which we have asked LC to, or the Legislative Council to draft into an LC that I believe you have before you later, we think is we're not sure we got the language exactly right, but it's a good start to beginning to implement what this task force has recommended to us, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for these gentlemen? Obviously, this is pre-session discussion, and there'll be another hearing on this bill at a later date and time. But we are in a little bit here. I'm going to ask you to help me by agreeing to sponsor some committee bills. This is one of them. It doesn't imply support for the bill, but this is one of the sort of the ones I at least like, because as all of you know, there's a tendency for people to come to the legislature and want us to get involved in these little tiny adjustments, and I would much rather continue to say, well, there's this new process, Mr. Jillians, and why are you here, Mr. Jillians, in this room? Just generally, people who come to the legislature wanting little parcels changed around. So I like the idea. Yeah. So, anyway, any questions, Representative Witt?
Not a question, Mr. Chairman, but with your indulgence, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank our two witnesses for the manner in which they handled an issue that appeared before the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee with the Oregon Hunters Association and Metro, and what has been told to me as extremely fruitful discussions that have been undertaken. And I just, gentlemen, appreciate the manner in which you've handled this greatly. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Witt. We understand on that front that it is impossible for us to move forward without the collaboration and cooperation of the hunting community. And so did not want to see them as adversaries, but rather as colleagues in the effort to create a place in Oregon where we could eventually release condors.
And the manner in which you dealt with this epitomizes good government. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Anything else? Go to the order here. Representative McLean.
You know, Mr. Chair, if this is a good idea, and I'm not holding you to it, but I perceive your thought is this may have some merit, why are we limiting it to Metro?
It's a good question. So Metro's got, and you can help me answer this, but Metro's got a somewhat unique set of circumstances around their UGB expansion because they have all these different cities and all these counties, whereas I think another city on its own can just do it on a more quick, is that in proper grammar? They can initiate their own UGB as fast as they want to, and Metro is time limited right now at 6 years. I don't know if that's by us or you, but they're on a little bit slower cycle, I think, than others.
Mr. Chairman, that you're absolutely right, and in
yes.
fact, on you don't like that when that happens.
That's right.
We could actually we have that flexibility for employment land, and we have that flexibility for public service land. So we could add a school anytime in the cycle, a school site anytime in the cycle, if a school district came to us and said, we have a site that's outside the urban growth area, we need to expand. It really is limited to housing. And so, and it's limited to us. So that's one of the things that we look at when we look at Wilsonville that we kind of wince a little bit about, because if Wilsonville was located in Gillum County, for example, as an individual city, they could make their expansion on their own with their own analysis. It's because they're in Metro that we add this analysis that the regional need has to be demonstrated before we can move forward. Again, I don't overall have a problem with that. I don't think that is an undue responsibility, because it keeps us from just blowing out the urban growth boundary. But I do think that there are times when we could use a little flexibility.
If I may, in answer to that question, one thing that Metro has done differently than the rest of the state is mostly establish urban and rural reserves. And so this concept is premised on the notion that we have those that we're picking from places that our region has identified as growth areas for the next 50 years, and we're protecting the areas outside that for the next 50 years for farm and other rural uses. So that would at least differentiate what we're doing. Another point is our management of the urban growth boundary is really a partnership with our cities and counties. They're the ones that would annex, would zone, would work on the infrastructure finance. So we're looking for ways to true up that relationship and have a little more flexibility with these very, very modest requests. There may be a point in our next forecast where we say we need 3,000 acres, and then it's a much more robust discussion about where that land can be had. But if a city has done the planning for the three places that we know of right now are Advance Road, which is 300 acres, West Sherwood, which is somewhere between 150 and 200 acres, and an area just south of Hillsboro, Witch Hazel, it's about 80 acres. So those are from our normal ongoing work in urban growth boundary expansions, those are very, very small areas. And if a city has a compelling case, we want that metro-city partnership to work a little more flexibly. It's just different than a Woodburn, for example, that is on its own cycle, can pick a moment in time when it wants to pursue a UGB expansion and then go through the process.
Mr. Chair, do you have planned for this committee any bills that are going to address the needs of, say, Central Oregon or other areas of the state that don't have the benefit or burden of Metro?
Well, if I get to continue chairing the committee, which is a major if, I'm sure we will have some discussions about, the fast-track UGB process that we passed a while ago. I want to know if that's actually working the way it theoretically was supposed to. I think that was 2015, Gary? 13. So I'd like to know if in the 4 years since we passed that, if that's helped anyone. Yet. And then the next topic you'll see coming up when Representative Stark can join us is that new affordable housing pilot project, whether that is still in rulemaking or we're actually going to use that thing at some point. So if I'm still here, the goal is to see what we passed, maybe add a few new tools in here, but see if the things we passed are even implemented or why not. I also, now that I think about it, like to know what happened to the regional Jackson County. Remember that?
Oh, I do.
Yeah, I wonder how. I don't even know exactly what happened to that, but that's been 4 years, 5 years, maybe 6 years. I think it was 2011.
One might posit that the bureaucratic resistance to the legislature's
actions
has bred contempt amongst the citizenry with regards to the capability of citing property, but. I will find another soapbox at another time than this discussion. But
I remember a bill. I think Representative Benz is working on something, and I've been talking with him about that.
I do find a bit of sense of irony in this committee bill.
But you're excited about it.
I wouldn't say.
We go quite that far.
You know what? A baby step by a 75-year-old is still a baby step.
Amen.
All righty then. Any more questions for these fine gentlemen? Okay, let's move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Oh, while I have you all here, in case since I scheduled over your lunch, you do have to step out. Sorry about that. I would love to get these committee bills legislative concepts introduced. Again, this is not an obligation to support them later or in any way imply that you support these bills. I don't believe there's anything really overly wacky in here, but if you would like a description of any of them,
there's a memo.
You've got a little memo.
I sure would, Mr. Chair. Just
sure.
My faith in the definition of wacky being different than yours.
If I made them as committee bills, they're usually more Republican. I was afraid to put my name on them, so you might like them more than I will.
All right.
I'm still trying to keep the gavel, remember. Okay, so first one, this is comes from, where's Brandt? It comes from our Broadband Advisory Task Force, I think, and this has to do with rural telecommunications and whether the Universal Service Fund can only be used to provide like landline service, which is where we're at currently, or broadband access in rural communities. So tap the fund to be able to use money that currently is being used for telephone landline provision to also be able to do broadband in rural areas. Second one.
And that was LC 104, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, sorry, 1004. So going down this memo, starting at the top, 1004. 1005, it's if you're not going to give us, I'm layman's terms, if you're not going to give us any money, then you should not tell rural telecommunications carriers that they have to perform these last mile obligations, if that's, I don't know if that's the right term, but either help us do it or stop giving us the requirement that we have to do these things. Six is, I think I wanted the relating clause, honestly, and it's a tax cut. That's why I was afraid to put my name on it. It's a big old tax cut in individual income tax rates. Thought you might like that one. 1548, I couldn't quite remember who asked for it, but I liked the relating clause. It's relating to land reserves. I think it was probably a Republican member bill, and it has to do with if there's a written agreement to designate urban or rural reserves, that they are in fact designated, and that there's if there's a written agreement, it should be enforced. But I loved the relating clause on that one.
Mr. Chair, that sounds exciting. You mean what we're going to pass a bill saying if we pass something, no kidding, we really mean it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's good to know we need a bill for that.
It's just the relating clause.
Okay.
I just want the relating clause. This 1691 is the one we just talked about. That would be some UGB expansion mid-cycle up to 1,000 acres, I think, is what's in the bill for certain purposes, mostly residential housing. 1829 is... Mr. Landauer talked to me about this many sessions in a row. This has to do with urban service agreements between cities and special districts, and there's already supposedly an obligation to negotiate urban service agreements between cities and special districts, and that still isn't really happening across the board, so this would make a procedure that says you really have to go do these urban service agreements if you have special districts providing urban services. Like in Marion County, a lot of fire districts will provide urban kind of firefighting services. LC 1890 is... What is this? Oh, yeah. This is, where's Bill Perry? He's not here, probably. He just has me put his bills in and then doesn't show up. Okay. This is something out of the Umatilla Basin, and I can't remember exactly what it does, but it's about improving water supply development in rural Oregon. What's that?
Regional
strategy development for water supply development, optimizing water development or water supply. Oh, you like this one, I think. LC 1896. This is, it's a study bill, but I want to have a more in-depth conversation about the removal fill law and its usefulness. There's many members have come to me over the years with projects in their districts that were in big trouble over removal fill. Then I started to find more problems with removal fill law, so I want to sort of go back and look at the entire removal fill law and understand its usefulness or not. Then the last one, changes water management and conservation plan approval. Oh, yeah. This was right at the end of the short session. Representative Krieger got very inflamed about the cities and their lawsuit and their water fish persistence, and they had to go back in time and fix all their water supply issues. And we got an agreement that last day for the department to not take any actions against cities in the meantime. This is sort of the bill that had passed the Senate that we didn't pass in the House. And we have a work group working on it. We're very hopeful they come up with a resolution. If not, this is kind of the hammer, the Krieger hammer, we'll call it.
I like it.
And that's the list.
Well, you know what.
Hi,
Alan. Yeah, Vice Chair Post.
I haven't said hi to you yet. How are you?
Yeah, good.
Nice to see you. Like the haircut.
You know, when we go into more detail on these, should we all be here? My concern, obviously, is always the same. So, definition. I am worried. You know, it's no secret. I'm working on a bill to. Require an explanation of the emergency before, and then a majority vote of the House to declare that an emergency based on that. So I'd want to know what the emergency is, or just take it off and do the 91st day after sign you die.
I'm trying to think of how many have them in there.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Well, actually, just
join in, Representative Donald.
Well, I don't always share Representative Post's methods, but I share his concerns. And I see, I think we're actually making some progress here. By my read, last time we had three out of our four measures had emergency clauses. This time it's only three out of nine. So we're making some real progress here.
There was something about a 75-year-old and his baby steps. Yeah, I remember a great man once said that. Okay. So... I would take a motion.
Before you motion,
nope.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative McLean.
So it's December. We're in an interim committee. Do you know if it's constitutional for this committee to introduce committee bills for a committee in the 79th Legislative Assembly?
No. Let me ask.
Great question.
We could probably, Mr. Chair and Representative McLean, we could probably check the constitutionality with legislative counsel. That would be a more appropriate person than me. But I do believe when the bill gets printed that it would say at the request of, that it's from this committee. So I can check the constitutionality of it, but it is on behalf of this current sitting committee. But I will... go call legislative counsel and have them.
I would like to think they wouldn't issue this to us if they thought it was unconstitutional, but that's no guarantee.
No, it's certainly not for
check
the speaker to expand her authority in a unconstitutional way. But I, for one, am a little bit troubled by the fact that an interim committee, which was appointed by the 78th Legislative Assembly, is passing and putting into play committee bills for the 79th Legislative Assembly. And, as you know, Chair, we all swear an oath to the Oregon Constitution, and I think what we should be doing is constitutional. And, you know, if the government's role in having perpetual session with these legislative days is expanding the scope of which we're trying to pass legislation. I, for one, representing God-fearing rural Oregonians that don't get to be here today, am not prepared to do that. And I do think the constitutionality is an issue. It's something we could certainly do as a committee on the first day of the 79th Legislative Assembly when we're all sworn in as representatives at that time.
So we'll take a little pause here. We'll get Dexter down here to deal with this. The other issue I know, because I asked, why can't we just do this in January? And for whatever reason, we couldn't. So it would need to be, as you described, in the opening days of session, like February 2 or whatever. That's when you would do it otherwise. So we'll...
I'm at lunch. I'm going to walk in. Do you just want to open it?
Yeah, we'll move on and come back to this so we're not when everyone's waiting for with bated breath for this constitutional crisis that's been generated here in committee this morning. And move on to hear about St. Paul water infrastructure while we go get Dexter from lunch. Woo! So, Representative Post, do you want to go up there? Or just
no, I'm just going to okay. talk to Beth. Thank you, Beth. So, colleagues... And for those who are interested in St. Paul, which every God-fearing rural person loves St. Paul, right? Because it's the greatest rodeo in Oregon.
Yes.
It's a good rodeo.
I have the mayor here.
I represent, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, just please. Yeah.
The Crooked River Roundup in Prineville.
That's a pretty good one.
Which is the greatest rodeo in Oregon.
I heard there was one out in Pendleton someone thinks
the
is
one in
good.
Pendleton seems to think they're pretty big.
Yeah, okay, yeah. But not like St. Paul.
But so. In St. Paul, we own the town for 3 days. All so right. Anyway, in Great St. Paul, which is in my district, when I first, even before I came into office, I was aware that there was a water situation out there with some wells, and the mayor will explain it in better detail than I can. But I became aware of it, and one of the interesting things I was able to do early in my first session was to go out and spend a wonderful
just
evening.
One moment, sorry. Yeah. The Buckaroo and Malala has just made its case here today.
Could the record reflect
there's
a dispute over what is the greatest rodeo in Oregon?
I have a House resolution.
I'm not
going to
recognize that because the mayor's right here.
Yeah. I am introducing a House joint resolution to name the St. Paul Rodeo as the greatest 4th of July rodeo in Oregon.
Mr. Chairman, I think we have an abundance of greatness as concerns rodeos here in rural Oregon.
I think we do. They don't have any in Salem, it turns out.
No.
Sorry, water, St. Paul.
Let's see. I forgot where I was. So anyway,
another first.
It's not a first. Believe me, it's getting worse every day. I found out that the St. Paul water supply there was some real issues out there, and I was able to spend one of the most interesting nights of my life at a city council meeting with the mayor and his council and the rodeo folks. And long story short, they need a new well. One is worthless, one is on its death knell, almost, and there's a brand new one that the rodeo has drilled, but it has some issues. Again, the mayor will tell you more details about this. So for me, it was just really interesting to be a part of the conversation. And then one day, Channel 12 News did a story on the water in St. Paul, and James LaBar apparently was watching TV that night. By the way, I never watch TV news, so I'm glad you did. He was watching the news, saw the story, and this, that, and the other happened, and we were able to have a meeting in St. Paul with several entities and find some solutions. Now, it's not all the solutions, but it's some solutions. And so originally when our administrator asked me if I wanted to bring something of interest, I thought, yeah, I'd love for you guys to hear about the St. Paul water situation. And then we kind of jumped over this hurdle with that meeting that we had. So it's a different story we're giving you today than what I originally intended, but it is still together and intricate. So with that, I want to introduce the mayor of St. Paul, Kim Wallace, and let him really tell you the real nitty-gritty of the story. But it's a fascinating story of a real problem that has somewhat been overcome but still has some problems. So would that describe it?
Sounds fair.
Okay.
Chairman Clam, distinguished members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to come and present today. I want to talk to you about our water issues. I've got a very short... four-slide PowerPoint. I know how death by PowerPoint it can occur in these sessions. A little bit about our system. We have your standard small utility system. We have a point of production, which is our Well, it goes to a little treatment plant where we disinfect and treat our water, and then to a storage reservoir, and then out to through our distribution system to our customers. We have 168 water customers. 28 of those are commercial. So we're dealing with a fairly small customer base, and our revenue to operate the system is derived from those customers. So all the money that we have for operations, maintenance, capital improvement needs to come from that small core group. We have the dubious distinction of being having the highest water rates of any small city in the state of Oregon. As a result, we have about 400 population. During the annual St. Paul Rodeo, we will be winding up providing water to about 55,000 people. Just on the 4th of July alone, we can have 25 to 35,000 people in town. And the weather's hot, that uses a lot of water. Then we have the livestock and all the rodeo contestants to boot. That's what we're dealing with. We have, in our groundwater, we have an iron bacteria problem. Iron bacteria is fairly common up in the North Willamette Valley, but we've got an abundance of it. We have a manganese issue, and now we're finding out we're very likely going to be dealing with some arsenic. When we treat our water, right now we're just disinfecting. Our treatment system is broken. We're working on that. So all we're doing is chlorinating. So if you don't get the chlorine level just right, what happens is that the chlorine reacts with the iron bacteria and you get that color. It reacts with the manganese and you get kind of a rotten egg sulfide smell. The arsenic you can't see or taste, of course, and I'll address that in a minute. But it causes that. And what you see in those pictures of the fines, we actually will get chunks because we have what's called bioslime. All water systems have it. Ours is a little worse. Bioslime is a naturally occurring substance. It grows on the inside of your water pipes. On the inside of the pipe next to the bioslime layer is something that's called biofilm. That can contain viruses, it can contain coliform bacteria, and it can contain worms. When you chlorinate, if you don't get the chlorine level just right, you can kill that bioslime layer. And as it breaks down, because it's an organic compound, the biofilm can feed on that. And so then you wind up with other toxic issues. So in addition to those aesthetics that you say, I mean, we're passing our water quality tests according to Oregon Health Authority. But that's what the water looks like. And you know, I have people, I mean, there's a hot tub. That's bathtub water and sink water.
Just mean, like regularly, that's what it looks like?
Regularly.
Holy baby.
Sometimes it comes out in clumps.
Yeah. Uh-huh. We flush. I mean, we have a flushing system, so we flush the lines regularly, but it builds back up. Our distribution system dates back to the 1920s. We have a 100,000-gallon reservoir, and that water doesn't go very far, especially when there's high demand. We have, and this is causing us a fire flow issue, too. If we have and we have some good businesses out in town. We've got Marion Ag, a big fertilizer plant. We've got Ernst Irrigation. Of course, we've got the rodeo. If we ever had a fire, we're in trouble. The fire chief just did a fire flow test here last week, and when he opened up hydrants on the northeast side of town across from the high school, there was zero pressure in the line. And that affects the community because if you have a fire, you know, you don't have water to fight it. It affects our insurance rating, so the residents and wind up paying more in insurance costs. And you know, if we had a fire at the school, you know, it's a real issue. The school is building a new gymnasium, and they just had to spend $10,000 to $15,000 on a new tank system just so they could store water in the event of a fire. The other issue with fire flow too is if they hook a pumper on it and they start drawing water out of the system, with that negative pressure, they can actually collapse our water lines, which would put us in a worse situation before. So what the fire department has done is worked out mutual aid agreements, of course, with Newburgh, Woodburn. They have tankers. They've also worked out agreements with the some of the local farmers who have wells, so they can actually run a tanker truck out there and grab water if we need it. So what we're doing about it, we are presently looking at drilling a new well. There's some issues that we're working on with that. The Rodeo Association drilled a new well just outside of town, and that went down into a layer that's it's a kind of a clay layer, but we're pretty certain that it's going to bear high levels of arsenic in excess of the 10 parts per billion that the Oregon Health Authority allows. There was some discussion of perhaps using that as a source of water for us, but with the arsenic, it becomes an issue. We can treat for arsenic, which is quite expensive. We might be able to blend with water from our existing wells to bring it down below that 10 parts per billion, but that's still kind of up in the air. You see, the center picture there is pipes. That's bioslime on the left. And what I'm looking at doing, and I've recommended to the council, is that we try and come up with about $42,000 to $44,000 to do what's called ice pigging. And they bring in a pumper truck, pump a non-toxic chemical solution into the pipes, and when it goes in, it freezes. And then you open a blow-off somewhere on down the line, and this ice slushy moves through the pipe. And the bottom pictures, you can kind of see what happens there, the stages. The water may look a little clean when it starts, but then the ice comes through, cleans it out, and what you wind up with is clean water at the end. So I'd like to ice pig our system. I'd like to clean our reservoir, which hasn't been cleaned in 3 years. I think it's probably a big Petri dish right at the moment. And our filtration system is down. We're working on replacing the filtration media. And at some point, though, we're going to have to look at potentially putting on a new complete system with well controls and a generator, because when the power goes out in the wintertime, so does our water. We have the entire system goes down. The residents are without water. Mm-hmm. So people around town have, they keep bottled water. I see a lot of rain barrels for flushing purposes. And in some cases, it's, third world. So I've talked about our new well, media. We're working with IFA on a new master plan to evaluate our system. We have a $19,000 to $20,000 grant there. We're working with Representative Post. The city of Woodburn has been kind enough to offer us a couple hours of engineering time to look at our current treatment system and make some recommendations. And then working with the governor's regional support team and IFA, they have some technical engineering support that they're going to make available to us. So we're going to piggyback on that. I've spoken with U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley. There's a federal program called the Water Infrastructure Improvement Act. They're in the process of rulemaking and on that, but there may be some federal funds available. So what we need as a small city is we need the technical assistance, and of course, we need the funding. So we're looking at issues, and one of the issues that we've had trying to get grants is that the census uses our zip code for determining average annual income. Well, the St. Paul zip code is huge. We have a lot of wealthy farmers out there, and so our average medium income is up there about $57,000. But when you go into the city limits of St. Paul, we're not near that, so we don't qualify for grants. And even in some cases, we can't get the low-income funding. So that's where we are. If you have any questions for me, I'll be happy to answer them.
If those farmers are anything like my father-in-law, no matter how good things are, they're dead broke.
Yes.
Always dead broke. Mm-hmm. Not 1 cent to spare. That's why son-in-laws worked for free. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
So, Representative Post.
Just a quick, again, addition to this. I was glad that, Beth, thank you for asking about this. The first two words in our committee is rural communities. And this is, how far is St. Paul from where we're sitting?
21 miles.
21 miles, and we're in rural Oregon. Yeah. You know, and this is what they're living with. And so that's why it's not just because it's my district, because it's really amazing that people in the 21st century, 21 miles from Salem, Oregon, are drinking sludge.
Mm-hmm. Bioslime. Well, bioslime's okay, right? It's the bio.
It exists film in all the pipes
that we don't.
You know, I'm not a water expert, but I'm told that this is, you know, it's in pipes, and it's, you know, as long as you keep the chemical balance in the treatment.
It doesn't sound good, though, from a drinking. It just doesn't sound.
Aesthetics.
It's a marketing thing, I know, but maybe we could change it to some other word.
I get emails from people, and they send me the picture of their glass right out of the tap, and it's got a glob in it.
There is one little chunk of East Salem that's not in the city that has a serious manganese problem. It's a private water system, and I remember canvassing there, and like every single person, that was their issue. But I got to be honest, I had not thought about it at the municipal level, you know, in smaller cities that already have high water rates. I used to work for a U.S. senator a long time ago, and we spent a lot of time working with smaller towns for grants from federal, you know, grant programs to help smaller towns, because that was usually the only way they could ever upgrade their water and sewer systems was federal cash. But clearly, we're having some challenges around Oregon still, regardless of the largesse of the federal government and their printing press. They still haven't taken care of St. Paul yet. So we are having discussions in Oregon generally. We had a little presentation a few months ago about other ways to finance water projects other than just government money. So there's this thing called the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange. We had someone come talk to us about to see if there's a way to get some private investors to find it valuable somehow to put their capital in to try and advance the amount of cash available for water storage, water quality, water infrastructure, because otherwise you find yourselves competing with school kids for money, and that's always a rough sell no matter what. So whenever you put funding up there, I always think of all the other people who want funding, and we got to figure out a way to segregate those so you're not literally competing with school children and six senior citizens for the same money. Okay. Any questions for what arguably could be the greatest 4th of July rodeo in Oregon, folks? Okay, thanks for coming down and sharing this with us. It's seeing the pictures helps to realize, I'm sure your city council meetings and the phone calls to your offices are not exactly fun because people are not happy. Oh, I haven't even let you all talk yet. If you'd like to, please.
Thank you, Chair Clem and Vice Chairs Representative Helm and Representative Bill Post for having Regional Solutions come to the table. My name is James LaBarre. I'm the Governor's Regional Solutions Coordinator for the Mid-Valley, which is Marion, Polk, and Yamhill County. And I'm going to be very brief in order to shine a real light on the main solution going forward, and that's Robert to my right. So very quickly, Regional Solutions is a economic development, community development program that operates out of the governor's office to best leverage the bureaucracy of the state, federal, and local levels in order to more efficiently deliver on economic development community projects that align with the regional priorities. And so there's three main components to that. There is a committee made up of local elected officials, business interests, philanthropic community members in order to set priorities for the region. There is a Regional Solutions team that is made up by a series of people from a variety of agencies, one being Business Oregon and probably one of the most valuable players at the Infrastructure Finance Authority, which Robert is from. And there's a coordinator, a person like me, that coordinates the priorities and the projects between those two entities. And so Regional Solutions, has already been mentioned by the good mayor here and by Representative Post, is playing in a number of ways. One is to try to bring immediate technical assistance to the city of St. Paul through that regional solutions connection, because the mayor of Woodburn sits on that regional solutions committee. And then the other long-term significant play is one of, again, regional solutions main players, and that's a representative from the Infrastructure Finance Authority, and that's Robert, and Robert's going to walk through a number of steps that IFA has already done and planning to do as we move this solution forward.
Thank you, Chair Clem and committee members. My name is Robert Alt. I'm with Business Oregon's Infrastructure Finance Authority. I just wanted to walk you through a little bit of some of the help that we have provided and believe we can provide. The Infrastructure Finance Authority is a division of the agency that funds infrastructure projects statewide, including water and wastewater projects. We have regional coordinators based throughout the state, and our coordinator has been working with the folks in St. Paul. We awarded a planning grant of $19,500 in December of 2015 to get the planning moving to address the issues. We have other options, another $20,000 from our Safe Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund that should assist them in that planning, 10 hours of engineering expertise from a program that we call Circuit Rider that we administer with Oregon Health Authority. When we get to that point that we have a clear end goal in mind and a solution to the problem, what we generally do, we have a powerful tool that we call a one-stop. We bring the city, all of the funding partners, state and federal and private, into a room and discuss what the issue is and how it best can be funded, giving really the city actionable steps as they leave the room, and the best deal. What is the money that they can get that will cause the least amount of pain to ratepayers? We do clearly have an option through one of our funds, as I said, the Safe Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund. The project and the community is eligible. That would likely be a below market interest loan for a 30-year term. There's a small portion of forgivable, probably 10% of the overall project cost. But those would be the clear steps that we can take to move this forward. And we do take, you described 26 miles from here being rural Oregon, we take our commitment to working with those communities, especially small communities, very seriously. We are a bank, but I think we're much more than that. We provide project help from A to Z. We have coordinators out there really making sure that smaller communities especially get the funds and the technical assistance that they need. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about how we might move this forward.
Questions, comments? All right. Silenced us. Thank you for coming down and sharing this. We will be curious to hear how this works out. Maybe you can come back and let us know at some point where we end up on this infrastructure piece, at least. The Infrastructure Finance Division. Okay. Did you? I saw Representative Stark at some point. I've now lost him.
He's there.
Do you want to sit with us, or do you want to? Feel free. You got your choice. I'm sitting by a Democrat. Sorry, buddy. We are going to just skip ahead a little bit to ask Carrie to come up. And per my point earlier, I wanted to hear where we're at with the affordable housing pilot project passed in 2016. And I think you're our only guest, so tell us what you know.
Okay, I will be here. Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie McLaren. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, the agency charged with implementing House Bill 4979, which you passed last legislative session in the short session. I think I can work this from here. Okay, very good. So I just wanted to provide, this is not a fancy PowerPoint. In fact, you can probably not look at it at all if you want, but it provides a little bit of an outline of what I wanted to talk today, provide some context of the housing issues. You can pause me at any point, and I can move back. The goals of the program, is, as we see them, the status, which has been made reference to a couple of times here as well, and then the outline of the particulars of the project. And I want to thank at the outset a number of people who really participated in this project for us, including Representative Stark's staff, who was there, I think, almost at every one of our seven rulemaking advisory committee member meetings. We had a very robust and, I would say, diverse group of people who participated on the rulemaking advisory committee, without which we would not be so far along and would not have, I think, the quality of product that we do. So we really took pains to have a fair amount of regional variation on our committee. We used teleconferencing to allow people from Southern Oregon to be able to participate, and so had a member from the Rogue Valley Transit District as well as from the Jackson County Housing Authority participate. We had affordable housing developers from the Mid Valley. We had planners from Central Oregon, and also a representative from the League of Oregon Cities. Chair Bill Hall from Lincoln County was one of our committee members. I know that I have left out many, but we really appreciated their input. We also, in a couple of areas, had a few subcommittees, particularly talking about potential conflicts with agriculture, or how do we think about how to measure whether or not a community really is able to provide the services. After this last presentation, it's sort of timely to think about those service extensions and capacity, as well as transit. So very quickly, where I say we are now is that we were able to get... We started when we thought we would get started. We got done a little faster than we thought we were initially going to be able. At least I'm hopeful that we have an adoption hearing scheduled for January. If there are some elements that come out in the course of public comment and in our outreach that our commission needs to deal with, our original schedule had that adoption poised for March of 2017. But we did have a final rulemaking advisory committee in November. We had consensus coming out of the committee, out of that rule. We're having an outreach webinar next Monday to cities and developers to get their input on the rule. And as I said, are poised to have a commission hearing in January.
How many slides-ish do you have?
I've got about seven.
We might just take a little pause
fine.
A second, just so Dexter isn't waiting.
That's forever. Absolutely fine.
So, yeah. Dexter, you want to join us for a second?
You want me to sit back?
Yeah,
okay. I'll stay seated.
I'm sure you want to be engaged in this.
I was sensing that there was something behind me, but I couldn't exactly read.
So do you want to rephrase the question?
Sure, I'll have to rephrase it. Thank you, Dexter. How does an interim committee from the 78th Legislative Assembly introduce bills into the 79th Legislative Assembly?
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. It's the rules that you all adopted at the beginning of the 78th Legislative Assembly that permit pre-session filing. And presumably the rules you will adopt at the beginning of the 79th legislative session will also permit pre-session filing for members, agencies, individual legislators.
So may I follow up? Has there been, to your knowledge, any opinion from your office or the Attorney General's as to the constitutionality of a legislative assembly duly seated in January every 2 years being bound by the previous legislative assembly's introduction of bills?
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, as you know, opinions from legislative counsel are confidential. And off the top of my head, I don't know of any Attorney General opinions that have answered that question one way or the other. But I will say that the constitutional principle that you cite, the notion that one legislative assembly can't bind the hands of another legislative assembly, must also take into account the way in which the legislature acts from a constitutional perspective, which is only one way, and that is by floor session voting by at least a majority to do something. And so by merely introducing a bill, a committee is not acting in a capacity that the Constitution would consider the legislature acting. And it's the legislature that is what is subject to that limitation of one legislature not being able to bind a future legislature.
May I follow up?
Please.
So, Dexter, if the Legislative Assembly for the 79th Legislative Assembly did not adopt rules consistent with what they have done in the past with regards to interim committees, and would these committee bills, if this committee passed to voted to introduce them today, be validly introduced before a committee not yet formed?
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, that would depend on the what the rules said. You would, or I should say the 79th Legislative Assembly would have the power to provide in rule that no bill that was pre-session filed would be considered. They would have that power. But it would the answer to your question, I can't speculate right now because it's up to the 79th Legislative Assembly as to what exactly the rules say.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I just submit that an introduction vote today is just simply hypothetical because until there is a 79th Legislative Assembly seated, sworn in pursuant to our constitutional method and adoption of rules, then there can be no valid introduction of committee bills.
Or at least there's a chance we've wasted our time if they adopt, if I heard it right, if they adopt rules, as they always have, validating pre-session filing, we wouldn't have wasted our time. If we do it and they don't, we've wasted our time.
Correct, Mr. Chair, but, you know, we've wasted more time just by
entertaining
me. Hey,
this is a good committee. What are you talking about?
But I, for one, you know, am a stickler for process, and I just think that this perpetual expansion of session, which has undergone, this is another example. We're here holding session for the 79th session, a legislative assembly in December of 2016, and I disagree with that fundamentally, and so therefore I wanted to raise the question whether that's even constitutionally permissible. And what Mr. Dexter is saying, yes, it is, so long as it's adopted by the next assembly.
Yeah.
And my point is, well, then let's wait till the next assembly.
Really didn't want to come back in January, but I hear you. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I thank the representative for this provocative question. Dexter, as long as you're here, the context of our question that you're answering right now regards the introduction of committee bills. I trust that the same answer would apply to the introduction of individual member bills and the pre-session filing deadline this week.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomberg, that answer also is the same. Yes, it would be based on the rules as you will adopt in the beginning in the organizational session in January.
Representative Witt, and then Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dexter, this seems like a process issue. So there would be a number of entities. It could be a legislator who may be returning the next session or not. It may be a committee that enjoys the same membership or not. It may be a host of entities that have standing to request that a bill be introduced. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, that is correct, and actually along those lines, it's there are among the entities are agencies, both the executive branch and judicial branch.
Yes.
Agencies. And actually, because legislative rules may only affect legislators and legislative branch staff, the provision allowing agencies, executive branch and judicial branch agencies, to enter pre-session file bills is actually a statutory provision.
So, follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So if I were to ask that a bill be introduced, that in no way obligates a future committee or the legislature to even entertain the bill that I've asked to be introduced.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, that is the most significant point, is that the constitutional prohibition on one legislature binding the hands of another reflects how legislatures in their entirety act, and that is through majority vote and floor session to enact typically statutory changes. And that's the prohibition. So all that is these questions are asking is, may a committee set in motion something that will cause a bill to be introduced, but that does not, there's no commitment to anything else.
Follow up. So feeding off of what you just said, then there are two separate actions, request for introduction and then entertainment of the bill by the legislature.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yes, at a minimum, from a constitutional perspective, there are two actions, introduction of the bill and then passage of the bill. But as you know, the rules and custom and practice set up a committee system that bills have to go through to actually get enacted. And that's all a matter of rule. The Constitution does not envision any legislative committees, actually.
And so as two separate actions, one does not... The introduction does not commit the entertainment of that bill by any legislative body.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It is, as you all know, when a bill is introduced, it's then assigned by the presiding officer to a chair, and then many bills are not scheduled. That's the end of the matter.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Helm.
My question was answered, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions for Dexter at this point? Okay, we'll get back to that. I do want to note that Representative Gilliam has weighed in. He says, the respect that will flow from any action from this committee will so impress any new committee members or chairs in 2017 that they will bow down to any action taken today. Because if only Claire Chem, that's me, and Leader McClain, and their ongoing games or respectful debates, let alone the rest of our membership. I tend to think that's true. I mean, I like to think of that as like a Christmas legacy we can leave for people. It's just the wisdom of this committee, but... We'll discuss this after Carrie gets done telling us about Representative Stark's UGB pilot projects.
Very good. I think with that, I will resume. picking up a little bit where I left off is really that to let people know that the draft rules are in circulation, and our commission will be having a first and possible adoption hearing in January. The context of the housing market, I'm sure you've all heard lots about it, but one of the important functions that the 2016 legislature did was to actually give the department some funding to do some research. And I think that was important in two respects. One, it gave our committee members, our rulemaking advisory committee, a common framework to work from. There's lots of data out there, but it said, here's the data set that we're going to try to work with. I think that was really important both to the what the rulemaking advisory committee was able to accomplish and the speed with which they were able to do that. Secondly, it really let us know where we wanted to focus. And as I'll get to later in this presentation, this bill actually does not also apply to all of Oregon. Certain metro area counties are left out, as is part of Jefferson County and Marion and Polk counties. And so it let us look at those areas of the state and say, who are we really trying to serve? What is our mission here? We're charged under this bill with increasing affordable housing for those that are needy in Oregon. Who should we target, and how do we go about that? So a few statistics, research that was done to collect, sort of give us a sense of what the need is in Oregon. And really a key point here is there is a strong break between, or a big gap between those who are in need of low-income housing, supported housing in some fashion, and the actual numbers of subsidized housing that we have around the state. So I think the other context of this bill, just as we all remember, legislative session maybe doesn't seem that long ago to you, but this was actually one of a package of four that was really looking at some tenant protections, inclusionary zoning and construction excise taxes, and then limiting voter approval of city annexation. So sort of a package to think about how do we bring and increase the production for affordable housing. Here, I'd say maybe we sum up 4079 in a question of, is a targeted urban growth boundary expansion, one for the provision of affordable housing, a tool that can be used? And if so, what does that mean? What does that yield? So the goals here, as I discussed, really are some apply to the action of expanding the urban growth boundary. Some apply to the land already within the urban growth boundary. So really an encouragement for cities to provide land for affordable housing, to plan and zone that land appropriately, to protect the land that has been identified for affordable housing so that it actually can be developed as such, and to prevent its conversion to other uses. Also, I think really important for us, for our department, our stakeholders, and the public generally, is to really understand the relationship of land supply to affordable housing. So the pilot project, in its base essence, tells our commission to select two projects, one from a city that's under 25,000 in population and one from a city that is over 25,000 in population. And I think less directly but implicitly to learn from those experiences and take something back to the communities and to the legislature on an annual basis in the form of a report. The legislation called out certain cities or certain cities that were not eligible, and those are located in Clackamas, Marion, Multnomah, Polk, Washington, and Jefferson counties. And really, I think if you look back at that, this was a pilot project, so let's target it to those areas where we actually think maybe the impact of the urban growth boundary will be less less felt than in some of our highest value farmland areas. So some basic requirements, most of these were actually laid out in the bill, required some interpretation and maybe connection in terms of how it worked out as the pilot goes forward. The site must be adjacent to an urban growth boundary, cannot be sited on high-value farmland, needs to be a site that's 50 acres or less, so it can be multiple parcels, but just less than 50 acres in total. Looking for really those projects that are not likely to be developed within an urban growth boundary, and so our application begins to say, well, explain to us why it couldn't likely be located. We don't have specific criteria. Those would differ greatly between different cities. A demonstration that public facilities and services can be provided, that we're looking at public facilities, water, sewer, transit to these areas, and that we've buffered it from natural resource areas that are being used productively for farm and forestry. One of the major tasks under the legislation was for the commission to define what it means to be affordable. And this is really where some research by the University of Oregon's Community Services Center came to play. We looked across Oregon and said, where are we finding those communities to be in need, and what threshold do we set? I think many of you know that for most public affordable housing projects, they often have a cutoff of 60% of the area median income as the level of people who are serving. When we looked around different communities in Oregon, we saw that it varies some depending upon the context of that community, and identified that at the 80% median family income, most of those communities, most people in communities who made less than that, were cost burdened, meaning that they were spending more than 30% of their gross income on rent or their mortgage payment. And so we have set in the rule the 80%, or are proposing to set in rule the 80% threshold for those who would be deemed to be in need of affordable housing under this pilot project. The legislation called out that they had to be protected as being affordable for 50 years. I think many would pick up that in some communities, happen certainly in central Oregon, some on the coast as well, along the gorge, that some of the housing crunch or disconnect comes with vacation rentals being used for primary residences, I should say, being used for vacation homes. And so it was an important factor for our rulemaking advisory committee to note that homes built under this project should not be able to be used for vacation rentals. Also, I think this goes without saying, but we said it in the rule in any case, certainly cities are not usually in the housing development field. So this is going to be a program that will have partners, probably either a for-profit or nonprofit developer, certainly the landowner that will come to the table, or maybe multiple landowners, and then the city leading the project. So we wanted a rule that was workable in a team concept. There is a provision in the bill that allowed for the commission to decide to also authorize mixed income projects, so projects that are not 100% 100% affordable housing. And the question became where to draw that line. I would say there was a pretty wide span. Representative Stark would agree to that of where that should be set. And where the committee came down in its recommendation was that 30% of the units be affordable. There were a number of members who wanted it to be higher, feeling that if we are really going to be making a public commitment in the form of bringing the land in for affordable housing, that we should be serving a higher proportion. I think the other side pulled back and said, this is a pilot project. Let's try to keep it as open as possible and see what we learn. And ultimately, I would say that side prevailed a bit more, and we arrived at a recommendation of a 30% of the units must be affordable. This brought up the issue of phasing, and so we have addressed that in the rule, as well as making sure that the amenities provided are actually in common areas. Say the last element, getting into the meat of the rules, is that there are some elements of sort of pulling up, trying to hit some higher performance standards. So this is not a point-based system, but communities will get extra consideration if they provide a higher percentage of affordable housing, if they're trying to serve lower incomes within their communities, et cetera. And so really an end catch-all of saying what best meets the purposes of this program to provide for affordable housing in needing communities. This is my last slide two. Another aspect, and I think this will resonate after you heard what St. Paul said about their water system, is a number of our rulemaking advisory committee members and also the department and our commissioners were concerned about the capacity of small communities to be able to apply for such a pilot. And this is going to therefore seem odd that what we added was a pre-application component, which is pretty cursory, for cities to be able to submit what they'd like to do, and then we can work with them to flesh out some of the required aspects of the legislation and the program so that we don't end up rejecting applications just because they didn't meet the criteria because they failed to fill out some aspect. So we built in a required pre-application part so that the department can provide technical assistance to those communities before we actually have our commission select the two final communities. There's a component of the department's work which this rulemaking supported, which we have done historically and will be doing in the future as well, which is providing technical assistance to local governments about how they can increase the supply and readiness for their community for affordable housing. As part of this, we will be doing additional outreach efforts to communities and updating some of our technical assistance materials for communities that might not want to take advantage this pilot program but might be asking themselves the question, what do we do from a zoning and planning perspective to improve and increase housing production in our communities? So with that, I would close. I thank the committee for this opportunity and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Carrie? Representative McLean.
Thank you. You mentioned did I hear you right saying there was a point system?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, there is not a point system for this pilot program. But what we do have is base criteria, sort of minimum criteria that communities would need to meet, such as what's called out in the legislation, show me that your site is less than 50 acres. Then what we have are some additional considerations that our commission can take into account, such as if you're doing a mixed income program, a project, and you propose to serve either a lower income within your community, so say you propose to cap the affordable housing at 60% instead of the 80% that's allowed, you get some extra consideration by the commission. What the commission wants to be able to do at the end is to say these two proposals that they will end up approving will do the best job of providing affordable housing for those communities and will be good pilots for the state to learn from in terms of the efficacy of the program.
Okay. So may I follow up?
Yeah, please.
I think I understand it. But I must confess, I probably need to learn more. It seems fairly complex and a lot of work to get an additional 50 acres ready to build some affordable housing. I commend us for even getting to this point. That's just a lot of work for a local government, I think. But it may be that I'm not clicking, so.
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, I should note, and I hope all of you know, we'd be happy to meet with any of you to talk about the program in more detail. And we are in the process. This hearing came along a little faster than we anticipated, and we were at a further, more advanced stage. But we are preparing a series of one-pagers and background material, and I'll certainly make sure that they're sent to the committee administrator in case that helps this committee in understanding the bill. It is a key criteria for us that this is a program that for which local governments of any size will have the capacity to compete. I think there are some structural issues that will make it difficult for some communities, and by structural issues I mean infrastructure issues. There are some communities for whom their land supply is less the concern than it is actually trying to get water and roads to a particular site. But I'm hopeful that we will be making this a program that is eligible for all.
Representative Post. Vice Chair Post, sorry.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I actually wrote this down because I want to make sure that I remembered and now he walked out, so I'm not able to insult him to his face. I very seldom remember what Representative Stark says on the floor, though he sits right next to me. But I do remember him saying something along the lines of, and I went back and looked it up, that this experiment, this pilot project, will fail if no one will build it and no one will come due to the rules being too complicated. I remember him saying this, too restrictive, that the bar would be set too high and that we'd be setting ourselves up for failure. And so the question is, have we set the bar too high? Have we taken it from here, where we legislatively intended it, to here, where Rules Committee or whatever you want to call it, a task force, has taken it? Are we making it too complicated? Has big government stepped in?
Chair Clem, Representative, or Vice Chair Post, I think the answer is no. At least that was our Rulemaking Advisory Committee's assessment, that's staff's assessment, and the department's assessment at this time. I will say what we have built into this is a fairly robust, for us, rules outreach project. So two things. One, and we announced it actually only about 8 days ago, and we already have 30 registrants for a webinar next Monday, so that we walk through the rules with members. There are members of the philanthropic community, the home building or affordable housing building community, a number of cities on this list who have already RSVP'd to attend the webinar. And what we're hoping before we adopt the rules is that we do hear from people if they have concerns. We had a number of planning directors who served on our rulemaking advisory committee, as well as a representative from the League of Oregon Cities, and we did additional outreach to cities during the course to try to hit the right spot. After the rules are adopted, where our time frame calls for us to do 3 to 4 months of outreach before we put the application materials on the street, again, to make sure that communities are aware of it, are aware of the technical assistance that we can provide, so that they actually can put together projects. My answer to you in short is no, we don't believe so, but that is an issue that we will be watching.
Okay. Representative Gilliam doesn't trust me to channel my inner Republican, so Representative McClain's going to read a statement. I'm deeply offended by that, by the way.
I think Representative Gilliam has chosen wisely. One comment that Representative Gilliam had was that the long-term solution to housing is not government entitlement through subsidies and land use changes. We will only increase the number of families who will fall into this endless cycle. If you ask the question, do we need to address the problem with emergency housing, the answer is yes. But only a private sector boom of jobs and lower taxes and less government fiefdoms, less regulations, etc., and economic vitality will provide affordable and prideful and independent housing. Anything else is continued, quote, public housing, end quote, of working Oregonians. And I agree with Representative Gilliam that it will be incredibly disappointing if we can't get this done. And he's absolutely right that it takes the robust economy and all these things. But at the end of the day, we're trying to do something. We really need it to happen.
My only addition to that was actually it's public hosing. I felt like I could have sold it a little stronger if I had been given the chance. It's public hosing.
Yeah, I'm sure that was a misspelling. No, okay.
Because there's a cleverness there that we've got, the two of us. That
there are just some things, Chair, you should not read. Given that you want to remain the chair.
Oh, yeah.
Committee.
Yeah, good point.
So, Chair Clem and other members of the committee, if I may, there are a number of discussions, and we certainly heard them in briefings about the gap in wages and what people can afford across the state. We are aware of that, and I think this is a land use response that we are waiting to see what the outcome will be. I'm reminded, and I guess I do want to make sure I share with the committee, that what we heard is a pretty often a common refrain from members of our rulemaking advisory committee is these deals take a long time to put together. The financing for real estate development, and particularly real estate development where it may involve a number of partners to bring to the table, can take some time to put together. We'll be watching that, and we'll be reporting back. The bill has us reporting to this committee on an annual, to the legislature on an annual basis. While I say that we are ready, we're trying to move forward, we're keeping ourselves ahead of schedule, I want to be cognizant of what the development community and cities tell me are their capacity to bring things online.
So I will say this. I cannot now remember whether I voted for or not, but that doesn't matter. It's law, and the key fact is we do want developers to not get trapped in a we can't move forward because the bureaucratic agency rule process isn't ready. If it's truly a market problem where we just can't find anybody who can finance or build it, no, fine. But we don't want to catch 22 where eventually, because we will get them, we will get builders saying, I'm ready to do this, but I don't know why it's taking so long, and so we don't want that to happen. And I think that's the key. It's clear this is the policy of the legislature. We're going to try this in a big place and a small place, and we want it to actually happen. Okay, let's move to water.
Thank you all.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about LC concepts again. Now, we've had a little discussion here with Dexter. We can have some more discussion as a committee, but I'd like to at least tiptoe into this with a motion, if I could. But first, why don't I open a work session so that motion is not out of order? So let me open a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee legislative concepts. Now I'm ready for a motion.
Chair Clem, I move the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 1004, dated 7/22/2016. LC 1005, dated 7/22/2016. LC 1531, dated 11/2/2016. LC 1548, dated 11/1/2016. LC 1691, dated 11/8/2016. LC 1829, dated 12/4/2016. LC 1890, dated 10/18/2016. LC 1896, dated 11/8/2016. And LC 1915, dated 12/4/2016.
Vice Chair Helm moves the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LT 1004, 1005, 1531, 1548, 1691, 1829, 1890, 1896, 1915, dated at various times. Any discussion? Representative McLean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your indulgence on this. It's a genuine inquiry. I certainly have great respect for how you run this committee. I've made it known that I think, you know, you and Chair Witt are exemplary in your committees, and I appreciate both of you. I'm going to vote no today, and the reason is because, at a matter of principle, we don't know what are going to be the rules in 2017. We're not gaining anything by introducing these here today ahead of schedule. Let my no vote be a pushback on what I believe is an expansion of legislative powers by having, you know, what I call a perpetual session. In essence, these legislative days spaced out in between sessions. We already have an even year session that has gone way beyond what was promised the voters, which was supposed to be budget adjustments or just small policy tweaks to the bills passed in the long session. 2016, if anything, showed that has not been followed and has led to divisiveness. And now using interim committees to hold, in essence, substantive talks on bills, substantive input, has folks concerned on east of the mountains that if they're not here during now legislative days, persuasive testimony could go unrebutted, principle that I just disagree with. We don't do a disservice at all to simply wait to the new legislative assembly is sworn in and the new committee is formed. So I am trying not to be disruptive, and it is with great respect for you and Chairman Witt that I have raised this in this committee to stand on the principle that perpetual session is not in our Constitution. We are citizen legislators. The people of the state of Oregon did not want perpetual legislative session. That's what this is. And it's time to stop. And so for that reason, I'll be voting no.
Any additional discussion on the topic? Representative Post.
Thank you, Chair Clem. And I feel the same way as what Representative McLean has said again about you and how you run this committee, and what a privilege it's been to be on this committee the last 2 years. But again, new to this rodeo, since that seems to be our theme today, new to this rodeo in the last 2 years, what I've learned with these legislative days is it always says at the top of the sheet, informational hearing. And that's what I thought legislative days were for. Informational hearing. Somebody would come from some agency or some company and talk to us about some stuff we need to know, like the St. Paul water today. Mm-hmm. That's what this is for, not for introducing legislation. So when I first saw the announcement that there could be, and not just here, but in other committees that I'm in, that there could be legislative concepts introduced, it didn't even make sense to me. And I'm not even close to where he's at as far as understanding constitutional or anything. It just didn't sound right to me. What? So I would have to vote no as well to introduce any. And because, as was pointed out earlier, why not just wait? It's not like it's going to speed the process up any. And even if it does, we have plenty of time on the back end, usually. At least I've found that to be. So, yeah.
So, Beth, correct me if I'm wrong, because I actually asked, why do we have to do this now? Because I didn't really want to do it this quickly. But there's a reason, which is we're in January not meeting as a committee. So by not doing it now, we essentially will have no committee pre-session filing. Members could still pre-session file because you don't need an action of a committee for you to just pre-session file. But essentially not doing it now, since we're not meeting in January, takes away the committee's ability to pre-session file. Even if I'm the chair and we're all the same group, we don't meet in January. So then what we would do is start the first week of February by introducing these. And it would, you know, slow us down a few days. It's not the end of the world. I don't feel that. I'm not really that. I don't really care either way, to be honest. It will just take another motion, and our bills, they're already drafted. That's the good part. So they'll just sit there and wait and not be given a bill number, so nobody can lobby them during January by bill number. They would just lobby them by idea. That's, I think, functionally the only difference here. And just give me one second here. I want to see if I...
Chair.
Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just offer my my perspective on this, and I appreciate the concept of, one, not wasting our committee's time, and I also appreciate the idea of not jumping the gun. But I think Representative Gomberg asked a relevant question about what's the difference between going ahead and accepting these as committee bills today and whether individual member could do the same. And to me, what I heard was I could, with permission of whoever had these drafted, go ahead and either with them or individually myself go introduce these with the chief clerk before the deadline for pre-session filing, and they would be filed. And so I don't see very much substantive difference between my doing that and having the committee go ahead and do it as a group. But that all being said, Mr. Chair, I'll follow your lead on this.
Go ahead. Take a second. So Representative Gilliam, he agrees with Leader McLean on many points that he's made on this topic. As a former co-chair of two committees in the past, and out of respect for Claire Chem and his truthful planning in anticipation for progress of this committee, I'm supportive of at least considering these issues. Okay, so with that, any further discussion? I like calling votes when I don't know what's going to happen. Any objection to this? Representative McLean, Representative Post. Seeing none others, the motion passes. So these bills will be introduced if the next legislative assembly passes rules that allow for the validity of pre-session filed bills by committees. They may show up as committee bills. If not, we'll find another way the first week, if we all exist by then. Okay, drought emergency response report. Representative Helm and Raquel, are you still here? Do you want to go down there, or you want to do from here?
I'll just introduce this work from up here so that I don't take time away from Raquel. I had two purposes in introducing this report today. One was to give credit to where credit is due to Raquel and Linnea at Oregon Water Resources Department, who did a fantastic job of staffing this work. You have never seen such detailed and extensive spreadsheets on tracking comments and perspectives. I've never seen it before. And then taking that massive work and reducing it down to something that we can all now ingest. The other congratulations I wanted to give was to the stakeholder group, all of the appointees to this task force. Came from different specific areas that have to do with water, water consumption, and water conservation. They sit around other tables from time to time and do not always get along as well as this group did. And I wanted to congratulate the stakeholders because they were constructive. Their demeanor was exemplary. And in the end, it allowed us to get more important work into the body of this report than we otherwise would have. So I think they did a great job. And I'll just point out one of the good decisions that the stakeholders made was so that we didn't fail to capture good ideas around drought preparedness. There's an appendix in the back of the report that captures all the ideas that were suggested for tools we could develop, even though those ideas were not agreed upon through a consensus of the stakeholder group and made part of the main body of the report. So it's a report that is filled with good information.
That's in the back part, has the non-consensus but still ideas for consideration. Hi, Raquel.
Hi, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, Raquel Ransier, Senior Policy Coordinator with the Oregon Water Resources Department.
Wait, but do you miss being, like, involved in our committee from this side at all, really?
Your committee is always a joy, and I remember being there when you were Claire Chen.
Yes.
So,
and Cheyenne's been through this rodeo, too, before.
Now, my understanding is you have 8 minutes.
Yeah.
Looking at? Okay.
Yeah,
so, great. We have 8 minutes to cover 13 recommendations. So this is going to be very quick for all of you.
Okay.
Representative Helm did a great job of noting that if you look into Appendix B, you can see some of the other items that we didn't have time to talk about or that there was no agreement on. I will try to hit on the points that really require legislation, and we'll go very quickly over, if at all, over ones that are more administrative in nature. I'll also note that a lot of these are around budget and resources. So with that, I'll note that both the legislature as well as the governor appointed members to this task force. I'm not going to go into who those were, but that is in the report as well as the executive summary you received. And also in the interest of time, I won't go through this slide here, but to note that the whole point of the task force was to research and evaluate potential tools to prepare for and respond to drought, and there was 6 actions that they were directed to look at. I'll also note that there was limited time, and this group worked very hard. We met 7 times between July and October. They started out with about 40 to 50 plus ideas, and we were able to get them narrowed down. Also, I have to, as staff of the task force, I was not a member of the task force, so I'm here on behalf of the task force. I feel like I need to at least point out that members did not prioritize any actions. We didn't have time for that, and also that they did express that their support for these will change based on what the budget realities are for the session. And then finally, there are more details in the report, so feel free to look through that and give me a call if you have questions. The report is online. You should have also received an executive summary of that with a link. With that in mind, this first recommendation is around data. Recommends that we need to continue to increase the amount of data so that we can better anticipate and forecast drought, and that also helps businesses, agriculture, and municipalities better plan for and manage their resource. There's a number of implementation actions that go along with this one if you take a look at the report. I'll also note that the report does list what the vote counts were, so you can see the level of support within the task force. They were required to get a majority. Co-chair Helm and Senator Roblin chose not to be voting members, so that meant that at least seven members of the task force had to approve it for it to move forward. This next one here suggests that the state should provide resources for conducting vulnerability assessments and risk assessments, as well as understanding the impacts of drought. And really, this is with the underlying principle from literature that we can better prepare for and respond to drought and potentially minimize the impacts of drought in advance if we have a good understanding of where there's vulnerabilities and potentially then be able to target those mitigation actions or response actions in the future. This next one I'm going to skip over because it is primarily administrative in nature and it goes into our drought declaration process. Finally, there's more recommendations here. So recommendation D suggests that the legislature should look at establishing a drought emergency fund and that this fund should look at both being able to fund, for example, drinking water systems that need assistance during drought emergencies, as well as in-stream needs for key species, as well as for agriculture. There's, again, quite a bit more depth in the report about that that I would encourage you all to look at if you have time and are interested in this one. In addition, there was a lot of conversation around outreach and communication. One of the key tools during drought is to be able to conduct outreach. That's an immediate response. What we found is that, well, first, the Water Resources Department doesn't actually have outreach staff. So the task force members observed that it would be helpful if the department had a person that would be able to do outreach, one, to help water users understand Oregon water laws, two, to provide more information on what existing water management tools we have available, including drought tools, and three, to encourage water conservation messaging. Another component of this was to develop a communication toolbox, and that was primarily targeted at these smaller water systems. You just heard the presentation from St. Paul, and I will say that we heard a lot about the challenges and vulnerabilities that these small systems face. So being able to provide them with tools to do this kind of outreach that other cities have found successful was another recommendation from this group. Recommendation F is around establishing funding for drought planning. We heard, first of all, the Water Resources Department doesn't have funding to do this, but again, from the principles of being able to be prepared and respond to drought and maybe prevent impacts from happening before a drought occurs, planning is key. We also heard from folks that they could leverage federal funding and that, in fact, some areas of the state had left, or one area of the state had left federal dollars on the table because they weren't able to come up with match funding quickly. So again, this one has a number of recommendations on the implementation section that is worth looking at if you're interested in this item. The next item is around funding for additional Water Master staff. Given that that's primarily around budget, I'm going to keep moving along. This next one here is, again, focused at what we heard a lot about with small water systems and the challenges that they have, and really the need for the state to address a lack of planning, support, resources, technical assistance. Think about that whole presentation you just heard. And so this one has a number of recommendations around how we can further support those small water systems. Recommendation I points at infrastructure funding and being able to, one, evaluate what the existing barriers are to, especially for these smaller water systems, to being able to access funding. So assembling a group of experts to outline the different funding sources, outline their requirements, and then evaluate those potential barriers. And it also points to the need to provide technical assistance for these smaller communities and individuals so that they can actually have the expertise available to them to apply for these funding programs. Some of these small water systems are are mostly voluntary, or they have volunteers running them, or part-time staff, and they're mostly focused on just trying to meet the regulatory requirements. It's difficult for them to have time to plan for such things as drought. And as we've seen, drought just exacerbates the challenges that these systems have. Let's see. This next one is more administrative in nature in terms of evaluating management options for stored water. So I'll keep moving on that one. And recommendation K. This one proposes that the legislature should look at opportunities to improve and promote water conservation and efficiency. Specific items to consider that were pointed out was tax incentives for water conservation and efficiency measures, or looking at making water rebates non-taxable income. We've heard that some municipalities that have been providing rebates have had to inform their customers that that is taxable. Okay, and this next one is around creating new tools for in-stream programs, so to facilitate in-stream restoration during drought using voluntary measures. One of the specific proposals that you can find more detail on is basically authorizing the pre-approval of leases. So this would allow an individual to basically get a lease approved and for up to 5 years, instead of having to come back to the department and pay the fees associated with that and have the evaluation done, they could tell us at the beginning of the season, irrigation season, whether they wanted to use that water in stream or whether they wanted to use that water out of stream. And finally, the last recommendation is that Oregon should continue to encourage water reuse. Not too bad. With that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Is there a paper version of that? You probably gave it to us electronically.
Chair Clem, are you looking for a paper version of the PowerPoint, a paper version of the executive summary, or a paper version of the report?
Report.
I can get you a paper version.
And maybe
like.
Executive summary, too.
Yes.
I like paper.
Yeah.
We can certainly get that to
also
you.
Logging, which means cutting of trees, and then regrowing them, which I'm in favor of. Okay, then. Any questions for Raquel? Thank you to Representative Vice Chair Helm for serving on this task force as well, and my good friend Senator Roblin. Sounds like he was there for some of it. I know he had surgery or something at the last minute there. Yeah. And anything else for the good of the order?
Okay, and this is your question.
With that, we will adjourn. Well, our final interim committee, our final committee. Now that everyone's left, for those of you remaining, I really enjoyed serving with you all and your attention to staying all the way to the end and sticking it out with me.
Thank you.
Those other jokers, I have no idea why we had them on here. I hope they're not anymore.
I think Ken Helm was an excellent addition to this committee, and very disappointed with Representatives Gomberg and Post, the other first-year guys, who left so early.
I am, too.
Ken is clearly the MVP of the first-year class.
Representative Witt still is here, like a seasoned veteran.
He's the chair of Ag and Natural Resources, and he's here.
He was saying
okay,
that.
With that, we'll adjourn our final committee with great sorrow. Committee with great sorrow.